Gera can hit them. Did! Oh, what a goal by Zoltan Gera! And still Baptista, yes! It's Cavani! It's fantastic!
One from David Villa. Oh, great finish!
He's done just that, he scored! Juninho's done it!
Kubu making another glimpse of goal here!
Hello and welcome to the Streets Won't Forget podcast special series, Mavericks. I'm your host, Dan Mountney, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-hosts, two Mavericks of the podcasting world. It's Ben Woolley and Harry Martinez.
Oh yes, the classic Mavericks intro, this.
Back once again for the Maverick Master.
We got that vibe going. Thank you, mate. Well, lads. I like it.
The sun is shining and we are ready for a wonderful podcast. How are we, boys, before we start? Are we all good?
Yeah, I'll make the sun's out. How could we be bad? Gagging for a beer, though.
My barbecue yes, very is much about so. To be lit.
Oh, very nice. Very Tasty. Nice. Well, we've got a quite long episode this week for Mavericks, so let's get right into it. And we're looking back at the men who started it all. So the mid-1960s saw the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, pop culture, hippies, psychedelia. It was out with the old and in with the new. People were starting to embrace who they were and living their life. And it was much the same story on the football pitch. England had won the 1966 World Cup. It was English football's greatest day, but for many, Sir Ralph Ramsey's regimented system was boring. They wanted excitement, freedom, creativity. Step forward. The Magnificent Seven.
Oh, what a name.
Yeah.
I really hoped you'd start singing a theme tune then, Woolly.
It's in my head. I'm desperately trying not to. But
there'll be no singing today. Boys, have you ever heard of the Magnificent Seven before we start this? I want to see if you've got any prior knowledge.
I actually don't think I have.
I've heard of them, okay. But I have no knowledge of them, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah, I've heard the name mentioned. Could not tell you who's in it.
Kind of like the Illuminati.
Okay. There will definitely be some names you'll recognise. A couple you probably won't, but we'll get onto them shortly. Because English football had been given a taste of the Maverick thanks to a Miss World shagging, champagne guzzling, pop star looking Northern Irishman by the name of George Best.
Who?
Now the Manchester United the Manchester United winger was a bona fide star. The men wanted to be him, and the women wanted to be with him. Because he did things other players didn't, he did things a bit differently. He inspired the next generation of Mavericks. But one of them, our first member of the Magnificent Seven, actually made his debut before George Best. And he was starting to make a name for himself at Fulham. A name you might remember, Rodney Marsh.
Okay.
I do recognise the name Fulham.
Yeah. Oh, for God's sake, mate. I've heard of this football thing.
Yeah, this football thing is quite good. We should do a podcast on it. Well, Marsh was a cheeky chappy. He once said, when he arrived in America at the same time as Pelé, that Pelé was the black Rodney Marsh when he was asked, is Rodney Marsh the white Pelé? But it was a move to the third division QPR in 1966 that ignited his career. He became a star at Loftus Road, scoring 106 goals in 211 appearances, winning them the League Cup in 1967 and getting them back to the First Division the following year. One of football's great outside-of-the-box thinkers and blessed with wonderful technical ability, Marsh could do things others simply wouldn't expect. A perfect example of this was a hat-trick against Birmingham City when he scored a wonderful header, a volley from 30 yards, and a slotted finish after some delightful footwork.
How good is this going to be? Oh, look, a lovely classic QPR kit, this. Oh, what a belter.
Yeah, some finished that first one.
Jeez.
The goalkeeper with no gloves as well. Those were the days.
Yeah, vintage.
Wokemog wins again.
Only thing that's missing is the keeper wearing the same kit as the outfield players.
Oh, yeah.
Go on, then. Oh, sticky.
Oh, what a header.
You know he got some sort of brain damage from headering that ball.
Is this going to be a perfect hat-trick?
Unfortunately, it's not. I was hoping it was.
Oh.
But,
three fouls in that bit.
There is, yeah.
That football.
Oh, the skill.
Come on, Rodney.
What's keeper doing?
Oh, I mean, sensational.
That gives you a taste of Rodney Marsh's ability on the pitch. But his maverick ways did catch up with him, though. So he moved to Manchester City in 1972. And when he arrived, City were 4 points clear at the top of the table. By the end of it, they would finish fourth. He was the scapegoat of this collapse, having underperformed when shoehorned into manager Malcolm Allison's system. Marsh was blamed as the reason for City losing the title that season, and he even agreed, writing in his book, right, no beating around the bush, I have to hold my hands up, I cost Manchester City the 1972 League Championship.
Jesus.
What a heroic turn of events.
City fans, though, they still love him. So much so that if you take a very close look at the picture frame next to the fireplace on the cover of the Oasis album, Definitely Maybe, you will spot a picture of none other than Rodney Marsh.
Oh, damn. I've never noticed that.
Yeah, so Rodney Marsh is the first in the Magnificent Seven, but now we're going to go on to my favourite one. Because around the time that Marsh was making his move to QPR in 1966, another maverick was breaking into the professional game. A player nicknamed the working man's George Best. Frank Worthington. Now, this is a name I expect you probably didn't. Oh, you do?
Yeah, I know Frank Worthington.
You do? Why do you know Frank Worthington?
He passed away recently, didn't he?
I think it was last year. Yeah.
Yeah, and some of the goals that they were playing, like obviously when he passed away, they were showing highlight reels and what he did on a football pitch. And some of the goals he scored are unbelievable.
Let's get right into that then, shall we? Because I was going to come on to it later, but now you've mentioned it. There is a goal he scores for, I believe it's Derby County. For Bolton Wanderers against Ipswich.
Yeah. This
Have
is the
a
one
look
I've
at
seen.
This goal.
This is
this
unbelievable.
This might be the best goal I've ever seen. Gowling under it. Worthington
now from Gowling's header. And Worthington. Oh, stop that. I've never heard of this guy. That is an insane finish.
Well, as well as the technical ability, some of the stories about Frank Worthington are excellent.
They all say he's the best forgotten footballer.
I genuinely, based off of the one goal alone, I'd put him up there. That is like one of the best goals I've ever seen, if not the best. To have the thought to do that, most players would bring it down, play a pass backwards.
That's the kind of thing that's astounding you if you see it now. We're in a much more technical era.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Game's
absolutely
gone.
So, to give you a rough overview of his career, a six-year spell at Huddersfield started his career. He got 41 goals in 171 games. And then he moved to Leicester City in 1972. And he achieved legendary status at the club with 72 goals in 210 games. Now, Frank, firstly, the important thing to know about him is he was a massive Elvis Presley fan. And modelled his entire look on Elvis. He had long black hair, knee-high cowboy boots on all the time, tight leather trousers, and even drove a Ford Mustang.
Sorry, this is the working man's George Best, yeah?
When does that bit start?
Look, I didn't give him the nickname. One of his former Leicester teammates, Alan Birchnell, who's actually going to come up in this story later on, he's not one of the Magnificent Seven either. He once said, "The bloke buried in Graceland was Frank Worthington, and the bloke praying for us in the 70s was Elvis." Apparently, and I wanted to find some photos of this to confirm how true it was, but I couldn't find any. Apparently, when he was playing for Sunderland later in his career, he'd often rock up to games wearing like a costume you'd see an Elvis impersonator wear.
Oh, yes.
The full-on white suit.
He's there with Jonathan Van Tam, mate. It's just dress up every week.
Yeah, he's going in as a nun next week.
Oh,
Bolton playoff final. Frank Worthington shows up in the fucking nun outfit.
Yeah, why are you boys dressed up? None your business, mate.
The other great Frank Worthington story involves his playboy lifestyle. Is probably the way to describe it. So in 1972, before he moved to Leicester, Bill Shankly tried to bring him to Liverpool. During his medical, everything was fine until they checked his blood pressure right at the end, which went sky high because of, as Frank claims, a rather attractive female nurse that was in the room.
Hero.
And not the fact that it's the 70s and the man's probably already had 8 pints that day.
Yeah.
Well, in a bizarre decision, Bill Shankly decides that to lower his blood pressure, he needs a bit of a break, a bit of a holiday. So he sends him to Mallorca for a week. But after, and this is how it's described on his Wikipedia, and I've not worded this myself, after encounters with five separate women, including a former Miss Great Britain, he returned for a second medical, showing higher blood pressure than before, and the transfer fell through. Now, I know very little about Bill Shankly, but you always struck me as somebody who was a pretty clever guy, would go about things the right way. I'm not sure sending Frank Worthington on a holiday to Mallorca was the best idea.
No, see, I reckon this is like an 8D chess move from him. And he's seen him play, and he's like, the fans want him, but I don't really rate him. So the only way I can get him is to be like, oh, he's failed his medical, sorry, lads. So I know he can't resist a bit of the Mallorca sunshine.
Well, then he's just being silly because Frank Worthington was a hell of a player.
I mean, we've seen one goal.
I've seen a lot of goals, mate. I've seen a lot of them. When he scored so many for so many different clubs. And he loved to bang birds. Like, at the end of the day, why would you not want that?
Well, on that front, though, you're getting shown up by George Best. Although, admittedly, he does show everyone up. You're competing with the master here.
Exactly.
He is very much the apprentice in this situation.
Yeah, he walks so George Best could run, you know?
Well, it's a different kind of cardio they're known for. Yes. I've got another thing on Frank Worthington, which I know you're going to love. Do you remember the Shoot magazines that Harry was given for Secret Santa? Well, there is a interview with Frank Worthington in a Shoot magazine from around 1975, I think.
Oh, got it. I should have got you that one.
That Dory, that's this year.
Some of the answers to this are incredible, so I'm just going to read you a selection. So Frank was asked previous clubs. His response was the Playboy Club.
Right.
Married, his answer was, used to be.
That doesn't surprise me, I'm going to be honest.
He was asked, this is a really random answer, he was asked, favourite other team? He said, Bolton Markets, half holiday, second 11.
That's a streets won't forget sign if I've ever seen one.
Mate,
Jesus.
The chant for that has got to be atrocious.
When he was asked, your most difficult opponent, his response was, the tax man.
Oh, he must have played for Portsmouth.
Here comes the working man aspect.
Biggest thrill, his answer was, playing against Bradford City in a practice match. Biggest disappointment, he answered, not getting the lead part in the television series, The Incredible Hulk.
To be fair,
oh, gutted.
I would be gutted.
That's relatable, that.
The most British answer ever when asked his favourite food. Steak, lobster and bacon butties.
I'm getting stuck on this working man's George Best. My man's talking about lobster.
As one meal or?
He goes and catches it himself. Fishes it out of the sea.
I wonder if his miscellaneous likes will convince him he's any more working class.
Oh, that's true.
Bird watching and browsing around hardware shops.
Oh yeah,
he's a B&Q walker is definitely a little bit more.
R.I.P. Frank, you'd have loved the B&Q paint section these days.
He would have loved the paint section in B&Q.
For his miscellaneous dislikes, and I'm not sure who he's throwing shade at here, but his answer was a certain dishonourable board of directors.
That could all be of them. All of them. Yeah,
yeah. He's left it open so that you'll go, oh, he's talking about my club. Yeah, fuck him.
Yeah, he's talking about the whole EFL.
He was asked best friend and he said the Earl of Openshaw.
Do you know what? I knew I had something in common with him.
The Earl of Openshaw.
While he's searching it.
I'm googling it, yeah.
It's actually just the British version of Aquaman.
Who is he?
No idea, mate.
Oh, nice.
Google has no answers here.
Couple of more answers for you. The biggest influence on his career, he said, my father, the late Eric Worthington, and Elvis Presley, of course. Personal ambition. Now, this is a working man's answer. To get rich. And then he said,
yes.
Own a ranch with five horses, which I think is the Elvis influence coming through there.
Surely he was already rich in comparison.
I mean, there's rich and then there's Elvis rich.
Yeah, that's true.
This is true.
That's true.
This is true. And finally, which person in the world would you like to meet the most? And his answer, Elvis's widow, Priscilla.
Oh, no.
What? Why not say Elvis?
But I think Elvis is dead by this point. So
mate, surely
my
still
guess would be
meet him.
He wants to talk about Elvis and probably shag Priscilla. Knowing
what I was leaning towards the second one. I was like, she's sucked enough.
She doesn't need two of them.
He rocks up in the Elvis impersonator costume that's been wearing to Sunderland games. Come on, Priscilla, love.
The Northern Elvis.
Yeah, we'll get you a pint of Vivi.
Tenants.
Right, that's
up.
Two down. On to number three of the Magnificent Seven. In 1968, another Maverick would come to the fore. Sheffield United's greatest ever player, as voted for by the fans, Tony Curry.
I thought you were going to say Ollie McBurney then.
Ollie McBurney. Lee Smuse.
It's not very often Sheffield United come up on this podcast.
No, I think this is going to be one of the rare occasions. So Tony Curry was a wonderfully talented midfielder, had a great range of passing, and he'd do things completely off the cuff. Maybe he wasn't the biggest maverick off the pitch, but he certainly was on it. And his most famous moment came in April 1975, when in an end-of-season game against Leicester, he collided with our old friend Alan Birchnell, who we mentioned previously.
Oh.
The pair sat on the pitch next to each other, and then Birchnell turned to Curry and said, "Give us a kiss," which he did. The next day, the picture of the two kissing on the pitch was plastered all over the front pages. There was even discussions in the Houses of Parliament about whether the game had gone soft, which I think seems a bit over the top.
I was about to say, I bet the public in this era took that really well.
This is where the woke mob started.
Alan Birchnell with Tony Curry started Snowflake.
Piers Morgan is always referencing that, mate. He's always...
You can't even have a Magnificent Seven anymore because of woke.
There's also, to anger the woke mob even more, a really good photo that you can find online of the pair recreating the kiss 43 years later on the pitch at Bramall Lane. It's just two old blokes necking on.
Love never dies.
I reckon if there were any of those like internet fanfic sites, there'd definitely be one about these two.
Alan Birchnell with Tony Curry.
Oh, God.
I'm shipping it already.
600,000 words. It's longer than the Bible. Let's have it.
Harry, can you change the podcast Twitter account to an Alan Birchnell Tony Curry stan account, please?
Yeah, if you want.
And we'll just start arguing with the K-pop stans.
We are now gone for a curry podcast.
Give us a kiss. Right, down south, we're going to meet two more members of the Magnificent Seven. Because just off the glitz and glamour of London's King's Road, Chelsea were embracing the Maverick. 1969 saw the debut of talented midfielder Alan Hudson, but 5 years earlier, striker Peter Osgood had waltzed into the first team. He would go on to become the King of Stamford Bridge and even has a statue outside to this day. But less about his exploits on the pitch, and more about his antics off it. Ozzy became a real man about town, and in 1972, when Jimmy Hill invited Hollywood star Raquel Welch to Stamford Bridge, she took a real shine to Chelsea's star man. In an interview, he said, "If I'd been George Best, I would have slipped my number. But then again, if I was George Best, she would have slipped me hers." A few days later, Welch was photographed wearing a t-shirt which read, "I scored with Peter Osgood." When he was asked about it, he didn't deny it. So God knows what happened there. But possibly Chelsea's one of their greatest strikers of all time was shagging a Hollywood star back in the 70s. Who knows?
Weren't we all?
Oh, yes.
No, we were. I don't know how old you were, but no, I certainly wasn't.
50. Been a long time.
As it seems to be a running theme on this podcast now, I've also found us a trophy theft.
Oh, give it to me, yes.
It's not the Intertoto, is it?
I wish it was. That would be the podcast of the decade.
That's us, boys. We're nicking the Intertoto.
No, absolutely, mate, we have to protect it at all costs.
No, we're stealing
Where
it.
Is it now, do we reckon?
Oh, one of the four teams to win it in its last year.
It's probably under someone's bed with the Jules Rimet.
Paul Scholes again. How many fucking times, Paul?
He doesn't deserve it.
Do you reckon UEFA have got it, or they like melted it down?
I reckon they've given it to someone really random, like Robbie Brady's got it.
See, I want to believe that they did something really like symbolic with it, like they melted it down and turned it into the new UEFA trophies. But I reckon it's just Toto Cup. It's just sitting in a box somewhere.
I reckon it was used for that Ronaldo bust. That's why it's not quite right, because the Intertoto was never quite right.
Yeah, if you look really close to the attic, you can see into Toto Cup, like the bottom left hand side.
You could see Newcastle 2004 along the bottom.
Yeah, they couldn't get the engraving out.
So, Osgood moved to Southampton in 1974, and they won the FA Cup in 1976. Now, at the celebrations, Osgood bet his teammate, Peter Rodriguez, a bottle of champagne that he could steal the FA Cup. Moments later, the cup was gone because it was in the boot of Ozzy's car and he drove home with it. He said, I slept with the trophy that night. I've slept with worse, I tell you.
And then Birmingham police accosted him on the way home for a picture.
I find it highly unlikely that Birmingham police accosted anybody in the last 100 years.
No one guilty of a crime, anyway.
The thing is, you know for a fact he's driven home with the FA Cup in his boot after having about 17 pints. He is definitely performing
dark arts.
That's
normal in the 70s, isn't it?
Exactly, mate. 20 and drive.
The following day, Osgood smuggled the trophy back into the club and he left it outside manager Laurie McMenemy's office and then just ran off and went home. At least the trophy got returned this time, unlike most of those stolen in the vicinity of Birmingham City Police. Number six of the Magnificent Seven, Charlie George. Personal favourite of mine. I've met Charlie George a few times. Only has 9 fingers because he lost one in a lawnmower accident. He was born in Islington, and before Thierry Henry, he was Arsenal's king of Highbury. He grew up just streets away from the ground, and he was one of their own, and he became a Gunners legend.
Oh, yes.
A true maverick, mostly because of his rebel behaviour on the pitch. There wasn't much off it. Some of his incidents include telling a linesman to stick a flag up his arse, flicking the V sign at Derby County fans after scoring a goal, headbutting Kevin Keegan, and stamping on the chest of notorious hard man Ron Chopper Harris, who was left coughing up blood.
Oh, Chopper, what's happened, lad?
Not many people are going against Chopper, are they?
What I love about Charlie George is he looks so unlike a footballer.
Yeah.
In like the modern sense. He looks like one of the wizard brothers of Harry Potter.
Do you think he looked at Dan and thought he does not look like a journalist either?
I actually met him as a child, so I didn't back then.
He definitely thought you didn't look like a journalist.
He looked at you and went, "You, my lad, you'll be a journalist."
Good lad.
Good lad.
We'll come to Briarclough shortly, actually, because he does crop up in this story.
Good.
Charlie once said, "I like to fight. Coming from the Holloway Road, you learn when you're in the pram to nut people who pick on you."
Who's picking on you in the pram, son?
I don't know, but he's nutting them.
Dan is a journalist, mate.
Charlie, give us a question.
Come on. Yeah, someone's like, it's like taking candy from a baby. Not round here, it isn't, lad.
Yeah, not round here.
A goal and a celebration I'm sure you'll have seen was Charlie's finest moment for Arsenal. It was in 1971 in the FA Cup final as the Gunners won the double. He scored that famous winner against Liverpool and then followed it up with the iconic celebration of him laying on the Wembley turf like Jesus on the cross. I'm sure you've seen it.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, Charlie George, who can hit him? Oh, lovely goal! Charlie George! Oh, what a fabulous goal by George! Clemens had no chance with that.
Ray Clemens had a goal kick and within about 5 seconds, I think the ball's in the back of the net. And for me, anywhere around 20, 30 yards, strikeable for me. As soon as it left my foot, I knew it was a goal.
There were some rumours. And if you look at him laying on the grass after he scores the goal, there's a slight bulge in his shorts. And there were some rumours that he got so excited during the celebration that he actually got an erection.
Look, I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying I get it.
Scoring at Wembley in an FA Cup final would probably do strange things to me.
Fully the same.
He has unfortunately quashed the rumours. He said, "As for that rumour about me having an erection while I was lying there, that's bollocks. I never got an erection after scoring a goal."
Did he tell you that when you were a child?
No, he did not tell me that when I was a child, thankfully. I will not have any slander put on Charlie George's name.
Oh, dear.
So to round us off, the final member of the Magnificent Seven took a while to make his name, but when Stan Bowles joined QPR to replace Rodney Marsh in 1972, he did just that. A wonderfully talented player who scored plenty of goals, Bowles dazzled with his breathtaking dribbling, and he was just the maverick they needed. Marsh, the man he replaced, described him as a genius. When Stan passed away earlier this year, the first line in his Guardian obituary read, "It was once said of Stan Bowles that he spent all his money on betting, booze and women," to which he responded, "At least I didn't waste it."
Disappointed it wasn't betting booze at Broads. It was right there. Like.
Yeah, it was right there.
Probably the more offensive. Let themselves down big time.
Do you know what? That's up there with 3-0 Walcott, mate.
Oh, I should sell it to him, yeah. That's big money.
The betting, booze and Broads millions. I'm sure you'll have heard of Stan Bowles. Obviously, he sadly passed away earlier this year. Yeah, yeah. Suffering with Alzheimer's, unfortunately. But I think he's one of the more recognisable names. And some of the stories are incredible. There's one about him getting a boot sponsorship with Gola, and they were paying him £200 a game to wear their boots. But when Adidas trumped their offer with £250, rather than accepting their offer, he decided, fuck it, I'll wear one boot.
I was going to say, did he wear one each?
£50.
Euro.
Sensational. There you go. He mavericked the odd boots as well, because Puma had those pink and blue ones.
Oh, yeah,
they were awful.
Oh, Stan,
I actually quite
game
liked
changer.
It.
They were a bit shit. I
what's
admit,
what
I
aren't Gola now Reebok?
Possibly. No, I think Gola are still their own thing, aren't they?
Surely they're not still going. Gola. When was the last time you ever saw Gola? Apart from maybe Sports Direct in 2004.
Yeah. Sports Direct, Gola next to the Slazenger.
Gola do still exist.
There
good
go.
God.
Oh, look, this is some of the elite footwear they're putting out these days, boys. Are you ready for this?
It's going to be those Bunyan shoes. What the fuck is that? That's a boxing
shoe. I assume they're boxing shoes.
Yeah, that's a boxing shoe.
I think so. Yeah,
that's what you're getting for fucking Secret Santa. <with you,
then. laughs> Oh, mate, you don't want a pair of these? Look at these are vintage, these are.
What the fuck is that?
From the first ever
they're
football
game,
apparently.
Selling them?
No, I don't think so.
I'm certain.
Circa 1920.
I've seen Cletus from The Simpsons wear those.
Harry, these are just your regular Saturday shoes, mate. I don't know what you're
they're
doing.
They're my slippers right now, mate.
Yeah.
Can you imagine you rock up the Sunday League and somebody's got them on? You are staying out of that challenge, surely.
Oh, 100%.
There are some places in Newport where they're considered high-end.
These are the boots he would probably have been wearing, though. And I'm going to be honest, I've seen these boots before. Gola, you've copied that design from someone.
Puma King?
I'd be impressed if it was the Puma King. They are a couple of years before Puma, I think.
Well, Puma have copied them, then. We've broken it here.
Have they not just taken a stripe off the Adidas boots?
Yeah, I think they have.
And put it around the heel. They've kind of got half a Nike ticket, even though Nike happened
many decades
later.
I'm a big fan of how their logo is just a G. Like, you've not even tried that, lads.
Oh.
The OG.
Well, wearing his Gola boots in 1973, Stan created one of his immortal moments. So he was playing for QPR away at Sunderland, who were showing off the FA Cup, having won it just 3 days earlier. So it was on the side of the pitch on a plinth for the fans to look at and enjoy. And Bowles bet one of his teammates that he could knock the trophy off the plinth. So from about 30 yards away, he smashed a ball at it and hit it directly, knocked it off the plinth and dented the trophy. The Sunderland fans understandably went ballistic at this, but he got the last laugh because he scored twice as they won the game 2-0.
Superb. Oh, yes.
There's also a short story that I couldn't find much detail on, but it definitely happened, and you would not get this today. At one point, he and a QPR teammate were put in jail borrowing a van that, unbeknownst to them, was used in a bank robbery.
Wow.
Can you imagine, like, a Jack Grealish, for example, today just borrowing a van to move house and he gets arrested because it was using a bank robbery?
I can 100% see
I'd have said not a chance, but because you said Grealish, I can absolutely see it.
Yeah, yeah,
like a G-Wagon or something.
A Gola Wagon?
Yeah, a Gola Wagon. Oh, wow, we cracked it.
Gola Wagon. It's half Adidas, half Gola.
Oh, God. Does that make it an Angola Wagon?
Oh, very nice. Got the Manucho in the back.
Fucking excellent. Hell, we're back to Manucho.
Well, that has introduced you to the Magnificent Seven as a whole, but their story doesn't end here because they were easily the seven most talented English players at that time. But it might shock you that between them, They earned just 46 caps for England.
Wow.
Who got the most out of that? George?
Tony Curry got... So Charlie George only played once for England.
Really?
Tony Curry got 17 and the rest were single-figure appearances.
They're all good answers for our quiz if it comes up, Willie.
This is true, yeah. So to look at this in a bit more detail, and I've got a few questions for you at the end here, boys, but feel free to chip in at any time. Post-1966, the media were clamouring for the Magnificent Seven to be given a go by England boss Sir Ralph Ramsey. And he would do that by giving them 15 or 20 minutes here and there. Just he could say to them, well, I've tried them. They're not what I'm after. They didn't live up to my standards. Rodney Marsh once said, Alf Ramsey only played me because of public pressure. Playing for England under Alf was a waste of time. Under a different manager, I would have had 100 caps. And if you remember a story from a couple of months ago, Alan Hudson is so angry about his limited chances with England. He's currently in a battle with the FA to get his two caps expunged from the record.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
The thing is, they're absolutely right as well, because what are you going to do in a 20-minute spell?
Nothing. Like, you're not going to do anything.
Gareth Southgate, if you're listening.
No, he won't do that, mate. He's too busy playing all of his right-backs.
Yeah, well, we'll also come on to Gareth shortly, because I've got some opinions.
Oh, of course.
A prime example of the underuse of the Maverick and how it cost Alf Ramsey came on October 17, 1973. So England were playing Poland at Wembley and they had to win to qualify for the 1974 World Cup. Tony Curry started the game. Peter Osgood was on the bench. And Rodney Marsh was sat in the stand in his suit, having not made the matchday squad. And the rest of them were presumably down the pub because they weren't involved in the squad whatsoever. The three lines drew one all as Osgood, who was one of the most prolific strikers of the 60s and 70s, sat on the bench and didn't come on. And England failed to qualify, so Ralph Ramsey was sacked.
Hmm. Well, it's come to bite him in the arse.
It must be
absolutely
nice.
Absolutely.
An England manager getting sacked for not playing his
for
team.
For poor performance, yeah. Yeah.
I say that like Southgate hasn't had.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you've reached finals and semis. Like, he's getting something.
Yeah, I was fully on board with Gazza. But now, I don't know. I'm bored of seeing Henderson and Dyer in the team.
If he played the right team, you'd win trophies. Like, there's no doubt about that.
We'll come on to this shortly. Because still to this day, the issue, I think, is going on still with England. So the England job was up for grabs, and there was only one man the people wanted. A favourite character of this podcast, and a maverick in every sense, Mr. Brian Clough.
Good lad.
Oh, yes. God, can you imagine? They'd be playing every week, the Magnificent Seven, and it would just be disaster after disaster.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you. Do you think Clough would have got the best out of them?
I think he would have done, but I think it had gone too far. They'd have reached the point of being Mavericks where all of a sudden things are getting a little bit out of hand.
I mean, by no means am I suggesting play all seven at the same time.
Nah, do it. Commit to the bit.
I think even if you intersperse a few of them in the team and give them more than 20, 25 minutes, that they'll prove something.
They definitely needed more than 20 minutes here and there. I don't know. As a manager, like, I get players won't fit your system. I couldn't understand just writing someone off because you don't like them. Like, yeah, we do it on FM all the time, but that's why we're not actual football managers.
I don't really see Brian Clough being a good international manager.
No, I think you have to be a very specific kind of manager to succeed.
Yeah, you have to work well within like 2 week periods.
Yeah, I think Brian would have got bored. I think he would have got bored, gone on TV, said something outrageous, and got himself sacked as England manager.
Yeah, like,
or
he
maybe
works well
he
with
would have
a
got caught drinking a pint of wine by a newspaper.
Big Sammy.
So the fans and pundits believe Clough would be the man to get the best out of the Magnificent Seven and lead England into a glorious new era with these wonderful creative talents. At one point, a newspaper poll had 95% of readers in favour of him getting the England job, which is a ridiculous number.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I don't think these days you could find a manager with 95%, a realistic choice.
No, not a chance.
Because obviously we'd all be like, yeah, I want Pep. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the only way.
95% is crazy.
You could see it. And even then, you'd have people not saying Pep.
Yeah, and it's not like Clough at this point is an unrealistic appointment, you know.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
He could absolutely get the job. Unfortunately, the FA had other ideas, and they went for the conservative option, the safe option.
The FA? Oh, that never happens.
No, I know. They went for Clough's biggest rival, Don Revie, the good lad.
Oh, but think of the butterfly effect, though. We never have had all of the followers.
We wouldn't have had that interview. Yeah. And yeah, we wouldn't have had Notts Forest. Yeah. Would he have won with Notts Forest? Probably not.
That is a wonderful butterfly effect. I didn't think about it like that.
Well done, Wooly. You are now the caterpillar who has grown into the butterfly. Well done, my friend.
Oh, that might be the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
I think it's the only nice thing I've ever said to you.
It's not got a lot of competition.
So, Revie mirrored Sir Ralph in the kind of rigid tactical style he employed. He didn't have room for these creative players. He wanted a very much functional system without the flair. He also hated long hair, which was one of the many issues with the Magnificent Seven, because they all had long hair.
Of course they did. As a footballer in the 70s, you should have long hair.
Yeah. Are you sure this isn't Graeme Souness?
What a ridiculous thing.
International management, I get. It's really important to have players who are like buying into your vision and your way of playing the game. Disliking them for their hair is the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard.
Not only that, but does it really matter if they buy into your vision when they're only with you for like 3 months?
I think that's why it's even more important. You don't have time to build a team, a squad. You've got to have people getting on the same page quickly.
I would think talent would outshine.
I can understand. Yeah, but look at England, mate. We've had all the high-end talent in the world and we can't get it to work.
Because he doesn't play them.
This is what I was going to say to you. So, in the decades that followed, the FA continued to make the safe choices of managers and underuse the maverick players they had. And I didn't realise this, but the tournament record from 1972 to 1984 is horrific. Get ready for this. The 1972 Euros, England didn't qualify. The 1974 World Cup, England didn't qualify. The 1976 Euros, England didn't qualify. The 1978 World Cup, England didn't qualify.
Wow.
The 1980 Euros, they go out in the group stage. The 1982 World Cup, they also go out in the group stage. And the 1984 Euros, they didn't qualify again. That's 12
really,
years.
Surely the football in England is not that bad.
No, it's not. There's
Do you know what I mean?
There is talented players out there.
I'm fairly certain in that run, English clubs are competing in Europe. At the highest stage.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I mean, Notts Forest are winning Champions League.
Notts Forest, Liverpool, I think Villa win it in 82, don't they? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's around then. I mean, that's shocking.
Even Celtic around that time are on the rise.
Like, don't get me wrong. It's coming home as everyone else in this country. Imagine being a fan during that run. I'd just be like, international football doesn't exist.
Yeah, you thought Sven was bad.
God, we turned into Wales in that stretch.
You literally did, mate. You turned into the rest of the home nations.
Oh, Scotland like to think they're better than that, but they're not.
No, they're not.
But it's funny to then look a few years later. So you look at Italia 90. They had Sir Bobby Robson, who was a bit of a maverick manager, and obviously Paul Gascoigne, one of English football's greatest mavericks. They get to a semi-final. The same again, Euro 96. Terry Venables, bit of a maverick manager, was somebody who would embrace the maverick. Gascoigne was a key part of his team. They get to the semi-finals again. Like when the safe option wasn't taken and these maverick players, even if it was just one of them, was utilised, the results improve. And I think for the FA, there was kind of this attitude of who dares loses. But they didn't take a risk and lost anyway. Like,
yeah, I think that's kind of almost the secret formula, though, is you've got to include the high-end talent, sprinkle it in, but you need the solid team around it. You can't just win with it alone. When it's used in the right way, it's fantastic. Like, it wins you games.
Yeah, like,
you've
got to
do it right.
You wouldn't mind Jordan Henderson playing if it suited the other inexperienced Maverick players around him, because he's obviously headstrong.
If Harry Kane could play like he does for a club, well, Spurs, maybe not Bayern, but he's still good at Bayern. But if he could actually score a fucking goal, it would be nice.
He doesn't perform at finals and semis and that kind of, you know.
And he spends half the game tracking back into the centre, like the centre of the pitch. You're not going to catch any of this lot doing that.
Well, this is why I wanted to talk about Southgate. So obviously, there's not the Maverick isn't really as common if it even exists at all in modern football. But I think you look at people like Grealish, for example, or
it's more Bowen. The playing style, yeah. Like yeah, yeah.
Or
Trent
Cole Palmer,
at right
for
back.
Example.
It's the yeah, player like, who's willing to take the risk.
And they don't seem to get the chance under Southgate. It's always such a turgid defensive style. But again, it was another safe appointment by the FA.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say he's a bit of a weird one because he has good success at tournaments compared to other recent managers, obviously not winning them. I think getting our two best results for a long time with a team that many not had written off, but were saying, if you're not playing these players, we're going to lose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's made sound tactical decisions, like the switch of formation and style in the Germany knockout game. That was, no one saw it coming and everyone thought we were about to get smacked. And then
it kind of,
Germany weren't in the game.
It falls down to the media at the same time where if these players aren't playing, it's all doom and gloom. If they are playing, then you're going to win everything. Do you know what I mean? It's
yeah,
that,
the media in this yeah. country is fucking abhorrent.
Like, I was thinking today
that,
of
that
how,
included, fuck you.
I was thinking of how Mason Mount, like 2 years ago, was one of England's star hopes. And look at him now, he doesn't even get a mention. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's literally who's playing well at that time. Like, at the moment, everyone's obsessing over Adam Wharton. Don't get me wrong, unbelievable player. Probably should be in the squad. But if he doesn't play at all through the Euros, come Christmas, people will forget.
Yeah.
So and the Maverick is so short-lived nowadays because of media, like, perpetual trying to write the stories. They don't live on. You know, look, people have forgotten.
Who stands out, they immediately cop all of the flack when things aren't going.
Exactly. Like, people have forgotten that Trent played centre mid and was actually pretty decent there for England because of how bad he is defensively. They focus on the fact that he can't play right back. Well, play him in mid. It doesn't matter.
Like, a lot of the blame has to go to managers being the safe appointment. I think a lot of the blame yeah. has to go to the English media being dickheads.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The combination of the English media and, you know, uncharacteristic managers just, you know, doesn't lead. They try and build excitement with the squad rather than following the manager. Which is why Big Sam was probably really good as an appointment, because he would have taken all of the stories.
He would have definitely played a Maverick, Big Sam.
Exactly.
100%.
Oh, yeah, but who the fuck is it going to be?
Well, this is the thing. I think a lot of the tournaments that England have been to in the past, five, 6 years, they've obviously done well. You know, it's been a semi-final, a final, and a quarter-final. But there's been times where the attacking players haven't all been put on the pitch at the same time. It always feels like he's holding somebody back.
Yeah.
To play slightly more defensive. And I just think if maybe, you know, in a game where it's 0-0 or 1-1 when you've got 20 minutes left, you need to win the game. There's just something where he holds players back
and
because
you know,
scared of losing
in that situation.
I don't know what it is.
You want to bring on a creative Phil Foden who's in the form of his life, not an out of form for 2 years Marcus Rashford.
Yeah,
yeah, it's the decision making sometimes is questionable for me.
But I think you get that with any manager.
I don't know whether it's again this like that comes from the FA down of like
of be
this,
safe.
This fear of losing and playing things safe.
But then
like,
does,
I just like a bit more pizzazz and excitement sometimes. It's just a bit,
oh, absolutely.
You know?
But does that yet again stem from any time we lose a game, or not even lose, we don't put four goals past the team, the press are straight away there saying, sack the manager, the players aren't good enough, the style
yeah.
doesn't work.
I think that's all of the public, though, as well, isn't it? Like I said, it's doom and gloom, and then it's golden era, then
it's
doom and gloom.
We turn up, we expect to smack every team 6-0, playing seven wingers and eight centre-forwards. And then we go, actually, we have to, you know, stop the other team from scoring as well. And yeah, they occasionally take it too far. But when you're treated like that for losing a game, I can see being
yeah, why you'd be
more
fearful
favourable
of
a defensive style.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. It's such a strange thing.
If Southgate was to go, and obviously the FA have got previous with doing like these safe choice managers, you look at Steve McLaren or Roy Hodgson, for example, not exactly exciting, are they? If Southgate was to go, would you want another kind of safer choice? Or would you prefer somebody more exciting?
That's aimed at you, Willie, because I've got no say in the matter.
I mean, as a Welshman, you don't have an opinion anyway, so it's fine.
I mean, for the good of the football, yeah.
Thing is, I think before he went to Newcastle, the likes of Eddie Howe would have been a good choice. I think mm-hmm. before Chelsea ruined him, Graham Potter. I think a manager who's got a proven track record, but isn't so...
It's still
past
raw.
It's the wrong word.
It's still raw. You know, yeah, they're young, who, they're proven their worth. They've proved their exactly. worth to a certain level, and now they have a chance to
do something
new. Someone
who belongs to this era of football, the nice way of saying it.
I know you've just dismissed him, but I'd still give Potter a go, I think. If he's not... If Southgate's contract is up and Potter is still out of a job, I'd think I'd give him a go.
Possibly. I think he's waiting for it.
I don't think you're luring Howe away from Newcastle now. I think they've got, they'll just throw it at
you. You know for a fact you're ending up with Steve Bruce.
And that's the one thing I don't want them to do. Get someone under 60, please.
I don't think Gary O'Neill at Wolves would be a bad shout either. I think he's done well in the jobs he's had so far. Maybe a bit inexperienced, but...
Would you take Sean Dyche?
No.
Oh, he's good at a specific kind of football. It's not the kind of football England
should be
playing.
Sorry, we literally just said, do you want somebody more excited? Would you take Sean Dyche? I know which
he's not even a safe choice because he's not the kind of footballing dinosaur we normally appoint.
He's not, yeah. He's the same as Big Sam where the wit, like I watched a video recently on, it was Stephen Warnock talking about Big Sam and he said, no, the style of play is so different what he tells you to what people are writing it as. Like they'd go into a team meeting and come out thinking they'd beat any team because of how they portray it.
He's a great man manager. He's not changing his style of play.
Exactly.
He's in that stay
in the
it,
team,
keep him up in the league.
In the team, you don't believe you're playing that style of play, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely.
But whether that would work internationally, fuck no.
Is all I'm saying.
Yeah, like...
It's that he can dress it up however he wants. He is a kick it long and kick the shit out of them at the back kind of manager.
Hey, 100%
he keeps
record.
You in the league.
That's 100% record.
I cannot argue with that. It's also absolutely not the kind of football England should be playing.
Who's the current under-21 manager for England? Is it Steve Holland or is he just the assistant?
No, is it? No, I think it's Lee Carsley, isn't it?
Oh, it might be Lee Carsley.
Yeah,
yeah.
It sounds.
Fuck it, get him and Gravesen as England manager and assistant manager.
The one thing you might get going wrong though is they try and go down that route of employing a new, young, you know, in touch with the modern football era, and you get either Lampard or Gerrard.
Right, I think you need a mix of both. You need somebody like Potter or Howe who are young but have experience.
Absolutely.
Well, all you'd need is like someone like Eddie Howe and their trusted assistant who is the one that keeps the reins on.
Oh, God, you know what that means for England, then?
Exactly, mate.
No, he's going to be in every picture.
Hey, he takes the limelight away from the stories about the players.
We'll win the World Cup and Jason Tindall will be fucking lifting the trophy.
Yeah, he will.
Full kit like John Terry.
Armband on, yeah, mate.
Just to go back to the Magnificent Seven before we end. Would you, if you were England manager at that time, at least given a few of them more chances? Because I think to all be in single-figure caps, apart from Tony Curry, is an outrage.
But the 70s, you're playing enough friendlies and qualifiers you really should be winning that you can give these players a chance. Like, games will come up where that's an option.
And
so
you know, it's easy to say yes, but at the time you don't know what circumstances they were going through. But the caveat to that is you haven't qualified for a tournament for 10 years or so. Why are you not just doing something different?
That is exactly it. It's that you know something's not working. Try something new.
Yeah.
You've got players here who are unlike everyone else in your squad.
The definition of insanity, my friend.
Do you reckon any of these players would be as good as they are, like, today? Do you reckon some of them would be better?
Sorry, did you watch what Frank Worthington did with a heavy leather football?
Yeah, but the defending there and the tactics is nothing to
that. You give him a Jabalani, he's kicking that thing out of the stadium.
Frank Worthington would be the best player in the fucking world if he was playing now.
It's like, you know, do you think teams would have been able to stop 1970s Brazil? Because of how tactically different and defensively aware teams are now.
Absolutely not.
The thing is, as well, they're like fitter, they're stronger, they're faster. Yeah,
exactly. I feel like, you know, what player can we say goes out and gets absolutely sloshed in the middle of a season now?
Jack Grealish.
He does it at the end, but he doesn't do it during.
He's done fuck all this season anyway, so clearly like, he's going wrong. Maybe in 20 years' time we'll be talking about Jack Grealish on an episode of Maverick.
Like, the reins on players nowadays, people like Frank Worthington would have gone mad with a nutritionist. They would have told
he'd have been dropped. His contract would have been torn up after, like, the eighth binge drink.
Exactly, mate.
I'm sure a nutritionist encourages him to eat steak, lobster and bacon butties. Don't worry.
That's true.
Wash it down with 8 pints of liquid bread. That'll do you wonders.
Bring back the liquid bread.
That's it. I want to sit there and say, oh, they'll be great. You know, be watching them week in, week out. It'd be interesting.
Football's so different now.
Yeah, I think it's such a... It's the same way if you put current players back in time. It looks so alien on the pitch.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I think this comes back to what we said on the first episode of Mavericks. There is a reason why they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And this is why we're talking about them. They should be remembered.
We get little flashes here and there. But not. Yeah, it doesn't exist.
It's not the same.
Like, talent-wise, we might still get that. But personality-wise, they almost can't have that.
Yeah, I mean, talent-wise, I think there are players, back in their time there were as well, but even today there are players who exceed them in talent. Like, they're incredibly talented people. Modern footballers are freaks.
Yeah, maybe not Makiko Gonzalez, but...
Have you found him yet?
I'm still on the hunt, mate. I've booked every taxi out in El Salvador for the next 3 months.
That's
but
not
they physically can't have the same personality. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, you don't get the boozers anymore. You do get the adulterers maybe, but you don't get the boozers anymore.
Yeah,
not that we know.
Looking at you, Carl Walker. However, there are a lot of stories coming out recently. I think the media, obviously, that's the thing, is that you can't have a Maverick when their entire life is in the media.
And there's been a shift fairly recently. If we now expect them to be like role models as well. Whereas before, I'd say they were idols, and I think they're very different things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree.
Like, you'd look at the likes of George Best, and you're like, I want to be him. Whereas now it's more meant to be like, you're meant to be someone that your kids would look up to.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I want to be him, but I don't want my kid being him.
Absolutely. Maybe when you're a bit older.
You really have become the butterfly this episode, mate. Well done to you. Yeah.
I've got profound things to say at quarter to six on a Friday.
You found your niche, mate. It is talking about 70s football. It's digesting eras of football from beyond the past.
I'll buy like loads of the decade annuals.
No, the Shoot magazines, mate. That's all you need.
I'll give you decade summaries of how the game's different.
Well, he's going to set up his own podcast. We're going to have a breakaway, and it's what he's doing eras football.
Here's what happened in 1974.
We got the thoughts from the Aston Villa squad on what their favourite drinks. Bloody
hell. They might not have got their chance with England, but the Magnificent Seven left their mark on English football forever. Without the genius and madness of Marsh, of Osgood, of Hudson, of Curry, George, Bowles and Worthington, we might never have got a Paul Gascoigne, an Eric Cantona, a Paul Merson, a Balotelli, an Adel Taarabt. Without them, the Maverick may never have been. And for that, I think we should salute them.
Sayonara.
That was another episode of the Streets Won't Forget podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. If you haven't already, please give us a follow and a 5-star rating on Spotify. It really helps us out. You can also follow us on the socials. Our Twitter is at @SWF_pod, and our Instagram and TikTok is Streets Won't Forget Podcast. And if you've got anything you'd like to tell us, your favourite Maverick, did you ever witness the Magnificent Seven? Please email us. It is the Streets Won't Forget Podcast @gmail.com. Boys, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, it was a pleasure as always, mate.
Have a good weekend, mate.
Oh.
Dish.
I will have a beer in the sunshine after that.
Get in the sunshine and have a pint with Frank Worthington. You can't.
So what are you looking like a drumstick squashy?
Have a pint with Rodney Marsh.
I was thinking every single player on this week sounds like a pint of ale.
What? Curry?
You know what, mate? We've got that craft beer bar soon. I bet it's in there.
Give me a booner.
Go have a curry. We'll see you next week.
1, 2, 3, 4. Gira can hit them. Did! Oh, what a goal!
From David Villa, great finish!
He's done just that. He scored. Janino's done it.
Yakubu making another glimpse of goal here.